I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. MC Warrior joins me now. The veteran poet has recently published a new collection of poems, Disappearing Minglewood Blues. They are of the coast, of the land, of the water. A lot of the poems in the book are infused with Mark's more than three decades' experience working in logging and commercial fishing here in British Columbia. You get a real sense of the air, the water, the trees, the logs, as well as other notable smells I'll bring up later. There's a real sense of the hard work that built a lot of this province. We overlook how much the extraction of natural resources in British Columbia shaped how we view this land and how we've been perceived outside the province. I ask Mark about the work he's done, the long hours, and the wisdom he's found in it. I'll ask him about how he writes poetry, and we'll touch on some of the challenges of writing. We taped this interview earlier this month, and like much else, COVID-19 and the coronavirus era was something we touched upon. MC Warrior was born in England and educated at UBC. He has worked as a logger and a commercial fisherman. He was also executive director of a Habitat for Humanity affiliate on Vancouver Island. He is a lifelong trade unionist at a member at various times of his life of the International Word Workers of America, the IWA, as well as the UFAWU, the United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union, LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, and he was a founding member of the Vancouver Industrial Writers Union. He lives on one of the Gulf Islands. This book is from Mother Tongue Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, MC Warrior. Mr. Warrior, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
May I call you Mark?
Yes.
So you were born in England, is that right?
Yes.
What sort of childhood was it like for you?
Well, it was complicated. We emigrated here, moved back. I went to school there, moved back, came back here definitively in 1965.
And so you came to, was it British Columbia that you came to?
Yes.
What was it that brought you here?
Well, it was my parents. They wanted to live somewhere that didn't have snow, I suppose.
Right, right. Yeah. And the sort of work that you ended up doing, was that something that your family, say, had a background in?
Well, my family, they were both accountants, but my paternal grandfather was a railway engineer, train driver, and my mother's side of the family, they were from Rochdale, cotton mill town. So they were hoping I would go on to be, go to university and all that, and I did a bit, but got caught up in other things and ended up going logging and fishing.
Yeah. The sense that I get from reading the poems in this collection, that it gives one an idea of what British Columbia is really like. I mean, it gives me a sense of the air, the water, the wood, the trees. When you look back at your work, do you think that's the message that it sort of conveys?
I'm glad if it does. I was trying to put across in what I was writing how it felt to me, what I saw, the connection you have when you log or you fish. Inevitably, you can't help but have a pretty close connection with the ground around you and the water and all that. It's very, I don't want to say tactile, but it's certainly something where you're really close to it and you're deep, really involved with it. It's not like living in a city, because you live, especially when you're fishing, you live on the boat, so you're always out there.
Yeah, that's the other thing we tend to overlook. I've lived in Vancouver my whole life, I guess, that so much of our economy has been driven by, say, natural resources, that the natural beauty itself is what draws people here now. I mean, you described, too, just how beautiful it is.
Well, you can't help but feel it, especially if you're, say, sitting around for a month waiting for an opening to go fishing in Koyukat Sound, it's, you're very aware of everything around you because there's very little else. It's kind of like being on lockdown. Because you're there with six people on a boat that I'm thinking of on one occasion. There's six of us, five other people on a boat that's 70 feet long. And if you want any entertainment, you drop the skiff,
yeah,
the rowboat, and you sort of row over to the island that's across the channel from you and then back again. And we did that for, I think it was around 30 days, waiting for an opening with one run in to pick up grub.
So you would be on there for 30 days?
Oh, usually, yeah.
Yeah, and then you would let's say after the 30 days, you'd be home for, would you be home for 30 days, say?
Oh, no, it doesn't work like that at all. In fishing, it's, you're out there basically for as long as there are openings.
Uh-huh.
Now, you might run home for a couple of days if the openings are close to where you live, to your home port.
Yeah.
But you'll deliver your fish and then you go back out again.
I guess I confuse the two with logging. How does it work in logging? My dad was a cook on a tugboat. And so he would, I'm trying to remember now what it was like growing up. I guess it was 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Is that how it worked in logging?
No. But I did know a lot of guys on tugs. And, yeah, that's right for tugs. But in logging, when I was working, you'd go up into camp and a lot of camps would be something like 10 days in, 4 days out.
I see.
And two of those would be traveling. I did once get, when I was about 18, get picked up when I was hitchhiking by a couple, retired couple. He'd been a logger all his working career. He'd go out after the snows went, sort of, you know, March, April, and he wouldn't come back until around Christmas. And that was how they lived their life.
Mm. It is awful hard work, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Both of them are hard work, you know,
yeah,
physically. They're also, you know, fishing in particular can be very long hours. But, yeah, they are hard work, but enjoyable, I'd say. It may not seem like it in the book, but I really like doing both.
I guess I'm used to the way my life is set up, that I found it awfully difficult. Or I got a sense of how difficult, how long the hours were. I mean, there's one poem in there, a couple of poems actually, where I would double shifts and the sort, and I would hate to work for more than 8 hours at a time.
It's just one of those sorts of things. I mean, lots of, you know, one camp I worked in, we did 10-hour days so that we could get 5 days off instead of four.
Oh, yeah, I see, yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Do things like that. Fishing, yeah, you'd be working from, if you're fishing up north, you start at 4 in the morning and you don't finish till midnight because you're fishing all the hours that are light.
And the there are a couple of poems in the book that I found particularly meaningful when you talk about, say, working into the night. These wee small hours of the morning, if you will, to borrow that phrase. Was writing something that you found solace in those hours, say?
I sometimes think of ideas, but I just never was able. You're not alone ever, really, right?
Yeah.
So it's very hard to do any writing. When I was in camp, it was always two men, at least two men to a room.
Uh-huh.
And on the boat, you don't have, you know, your own stateroom or anything like that. So you're always surrounded by people. That makes it hard to write. You might get some ideas, etc., but I always did my writing when I left, or when I was home.
It must be something, then, if you do it at home, that these observations that you make, these experiences that you've had, are so visceral that they translate so easily to the words that you use in your poetry.
I suppose so, yes. I mean, something like when you're traveling up, I mean, I used to love going up the West Coast in the fall because usually pretty bouncy, so you get a kind of a fair ride without having to pave to go to the P&E. There's the poem about that owl that drops down onto the rim of the drum.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was that happened, and it was a brown with white spots owl. And I know a twitcher, I don't really know my birds, but it looked to me like it could be a spotted owl that at the time Jack Monroe was telling Wallace to shoot him if he found him.
Yeah.
And anyway, I mean, it's just, yes, you remember things like that when you get back vividly. You know, there's lots of things like that. You remember boats sinking around you, things like this. Because one of the things about these jobs is that they're still dangerous, but they were even more dangerous at the time. I was, logging in particular. Uh-huh. 30, 40 guys a year were getting killed in British Columbia. And so all this tends to make you, I mean, it means that there's a kind of brotherhood, as it were. Even if you don't like people, you have more in common with them than you do with a lot of people who haven't got the same experience.
Uh-huh.
And there is that sense, there's a sense of community, or certainly used to be because there were more people doing it, but in fishing, everybody kind of knew each other. Even if, you lived in Prince Rupert and I lived in Ladner.
Yeah.
I kind of, if you were in the same fleet, I would kind of know, I've heard about you probably, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I noticed is the spare language of poetry says so much more than, say, prose. There are poems in this book that look easy. I mean, it's deceptively easy because, it does take a lot of work to put this together. I mean, to work on a poem. I'm thinking of the poem about the grievance meeting, for example. That says so much in so few words. And I'm wondering, is that something that can be taught, say?
I don't know. I mean, I grew up, my childhood was complicated, shall we say, but I grew up reading Greek, learning Greek and Latin. So I learned a lot of that stuff. I absorbed it from the subjects I took at school. I loved that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I've seen poems by other people, loggers. Well, just recently I'm thinking of, a fellow called David Miller who's writing some stuff that I think really, really has, captures a whole lot of the feeling too. And when he's at his best is when he's doing that kind of simple, deceptively simple, stripping everything away to, to get the images that best tell the story.
I've talked to writers, Mark, over the years, and a lot of them say that, and agree if I make the point that a lot of writing is rewriting. Is that the same with poetry? Is there a lot of stripping away that goes on, say?
I find that, yes. In fact, if I were given half a chance, I'd be rewriting some of the stuff that's in the book still.
Really?
I never stop, unfortunately.
Yeah.
A lot of poems start out much longer than they end up for me, because it turns out that really it's not necessary. And I don't have a sense of, I have this point I want to get across. For me, it's always just a feeling, and does it get the feeling across? Even though there may be an intellectual point involved, it's reduced to a feeling for me, and I just look at it and go, no, this is all excess verbiage.
When you look back, you feel like you want to make a change here or there. There's certain feelings, as I was telling you a moment ago, that were evoked for me as I was reading your book. Smells, especially. I mean, the smell of salt water and diesel, for example, was something that I was reminded of. as I was reading some of the poems in the book, even Seagull Shit, for example. That's something that I thought about as I was reading the book. Do you remember where you were when you wrote a lot of this stuff?
Yeah, I do. I don't necessarily remember the circumstances that prompted it, but, you know, I have a poem about, it was at Franklin River, and which doesn't even really exist anymore. It used to be a pretty big camp near Port Alberni.
Uh-huh.
And, I remember that very well. And then some of the people I was working with and everything, you know, I can still smell and taste things, in fact, if I think about it. There are a couple of poems that I wrote that it's some years after I stopped fishing.
Mm.
But I can still remember the smells and the smell of tar and from the deck of a wooden seine boat and so on.
Yeah, yeah. What you touched on this a moment ago. There are notes at the end of some of these poems explaining what some of the terms used mean. There's a certain vernacular that emerges from this sort of work that you've done over the years, and I get a sense that it's a language that I guess sometimes it emerges from one being away from home.
I guess so. It's interesting that a lot of the terminology of logging comes from sailing.
Mm.
You're using blocks,
yeah,
fair leads, all kinds of things like that. And logging are skills that sailors have or used to have, splicing wire rope, which I don't have a poem about, but things like that. Because there was a language of a trade that tended to be completely separate from people who lived ashore. And logging at that time, anyway, there were a lot of loggers who did live, in places like Port Alberni. They might go from home to where the setting was. But a lot of loggers at that time were also isolated and lived completely away from home most of the time.
Do you miss the work itself, Mark?
Yeah. I still actually engage in what I call sports logging or recreation logging. That is, I fall and buck my own firewood.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I do miss, all fishermen who retire miss being out at sea.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell. Something we all tend to feel. I have a story that I like to introduce, a poem about a Lot Bay elegy and about moving to Gabriola because of feeling somewhat like our youth. I have a story I like to introduce that with about meeting Chief Joseph. I've forgotten. Yeah, it was Chief Bob Joseph. I met Chief Bob Joseph because I know a nephew of his,
uh-huh.
Bob Chamberlain, and Bob introduced me as somebody he'd met fishing and to Bob Joseph, and Bob Joseph says, "Oh yeah, well I know I used to log and I used to fish too, right?"
Uh-huh.
And he was telling me some stories about his days doing it, and everybody who logs and fishes has stories like that. And they were good stories and so on. But the thing that really struck me was at the end of it, he says, "Of course, things aren't like that anymore. That way of life has vanished. But for the two of us, there was something that we had in common, even though we'd never met before. We immediately had a sense of, yeah, we know how that works."
Yeah.
What that life is like,
Yeah. And so I've reached you at your home in on Gabriola. It's proximity. I guess you have trees that you can fall. And then the proximity to water, I guess, is close. And so, you can see Vancouver, I guess, from where you are, right?
Yeah, actually, I can, yeah. Well, it's a five-minute walk down to the beach, but yeah.
Yeah. And is it something that you had to be near the water, say?
My wife, who grew up in Ladner, fished herself for a while, for both of us, we need to be near water. She grew up on the Fraser River, uh-huh. Right across in Port Michon there. And, you feel that need to be around the water and the trees. You know, I just don't like to be in a city very much anymore.
Yeah. See, I've lived my whole life in Vancouver. I see the mountains, I guess, if I'm outside, and I'm in East Van, so the water is not really, close. I mean, I see the water every day, if you will, on television, you see the traffic report or something. If I'm traveling somewhere, if I'm away, I remember I was in Texas once, and you know how flat it is, and you know, it's just land you see forever, right? By the time I got to Vancouver, I realized how much I missed it.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I lived in the East End, too, for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And, at the East End, even, I mean, there's trees. Along the streets, there's still a better sense of, because of the mountains and the fact that you can kind of see the water if you, make a bit of an effort and all that. It just feels much, much better. I mean, I've lived in London, too, and I don't mean Ontario. Uh-huh. And that just, I couldn't stand,
Do you write to please yourself first?
Yes. I don't... I've never really been very involved in writing circles. I've known some people, but I haven't really... So I've always just seen it as a... I haven't wanted to get too much involved in that, that sort of thing. So I've always been writing more for myself, and with an idea that people that I work with, some poems, the ones that are about work, other poems, no. If I'm writing about doing, Zen meditation, well, that's not necessarily for anybody but me. But
the
poems I write about work, say grievance procedure, the one you were talking about, that's for people I know in the labor movement. It's a poem about what it's like to do our job if we're trade union officials. It varies, but me first, I need to feel that it's expressing something about what I was, feeling or thinking about, and that it does express that feeling well enough for me to begin with.
It's an enjoyable book. I can't tell you how much it reminded me of why I like this part of the world that we live in. And I worked graveyard shift for a number of years growing up, and it reminded me of what I didn't like about that part of it. And there's just so much in the book that I enjoyed. By the way, I haven't asked you about the title of the book. Disappearing Minglewood Blues. I'm sure you're going to be asked this for readers of the book. Why did you title it as you have?
Because the poem Disappearing Minglewood Blues just sort of sums up, sums up the book in a way, because it talks a bit about, being in a primary industry, from selling chokeholds to the green men. It talks about greeting the dawn, sitting on a lotus chair, that kind of thing, and also a sense of, really we just all, we're none of us permanently here, and once we're gone, really you don't leave that much of a trace, but it's not that important either, that. And so, it's at the end of the book because of The story of how I chose the title for that poem is simply that I was listening to Grateful Dead's first album, listening to that song, and I was thinking, then I realized, I'd always thought it was I was born in a death cell, but it's not. I was I was born in a desert is how what the dead sing, and I'd always thought it was born in a death cell. And then I just started thinking, what if I and developed you could actually sing that poem if you could sing, which I can't, to the dead, new Minglewood blues.
I was, something you just said made me think of something I read a few weeks ago. I was reading something about Noel Coward, and someone who knew him near the end of his life said he was really worried about the legacy that he left and that whether he would be remembered or not. You said a moment ago that really doesn't matter. What do you make of people who obsess about whatever trace that they leave back once they're gone?
I feel sorry for you because you're wasting your time. A, you have absolutely no control over it, and B, there's 3,000 years of human history, and how many people can you remember from that period? Well, you've got Shakespeare, you've got Homer, and damn few kings and so on, generals.
Yeah.
So I think trying to think that you're going to leave a memory is really a waste of time. If you do, well, that'll be, you'll be lucky, except, again, it won't matter to you.
You're not around anymore, yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, what is this time of this era that we're living in, this COVID time, what is this meant for you?
Well, honestly, it feels like something where, you have to do certain things because that's what the chief medical officer is telling you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't know, I read about all this stuff, et cetera, and I've read about lots of stuff. I mean, I am an historian as well, and I've read lots of stuff about the Black Death, all that stuff, but I'm not in a position to judge, and you have to accept that as long as these people seem competent, unlike some people we know to the south of us,
sure.
You have to just do what they say, and you have to hope for the best. There's no sense obsessing about, you might die from it, and so on and so forth. You have no control over that, except for, insofar as you follow that the instructions are and hope for the best. But I try not to let what's going on bother me. It's scary going into grocery stores, as much because other people are scared,
yeah,
as it is because of anything that's lurking there,
Yeah. Mark, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. I enjoyed reading this book a great deal. Congratulations on it and good luck with it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The book is called Disappearing Minglewood Blues. It is published by Mother Tongue. It's author MC Warrior joined me on the line from one of the Gulf Islands here in British Columbia. And until the fall in Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.